From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, how America has betrayed the Iraqis who trusted America the most. We talk with George Packer about his article, Betrayed, in the current edition of The New Yorker. He says that Iraqis who have worked with Americans in Iraq as translators and in other positions are seen as collaborators by extremist Sunni and Shia Iraqis and have been targeted for death, but America has done little to help them. Packer has made 6 trips to Iraq. And we'll talk with Daniel Byman about the ripple effects of the war in Iraq, the region, and on worldwide terrorism. Byman is the director of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University and is a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America has betrayed the Iraqis who trusted America the most, according to the new article Betrayed in the current edition of The New Yorker. My guest is the author, George Packer. His article is about Iraqis who have worked as interpreters and in other capacities with the Americans in Iraq, only to find themselves labeled collaborators and targeted for death by Sunni and Shiite militias in Iraq. Packer writes that when Iraqi employees of the U.S. military began to be kidnapped and killed in large numbers, there was essentially no American response. Packer is a staff writer for The New Yorker and won an Overseas Press Club Award for his coverage of Iraq. He wrote the 2005 book The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. Packer has made 6 trips to Iraq. His latest was in January. George Packer, welcome to Fresh Air. What are some of the jobs involving Iraqis working with Americans in Iraq that have become really dangerous to do?
Well, the most common job is interpreting. Iraqis flock to the Marines and the Army when Americans first came to Baghdad, and that was the job that most of them expected to do and asked to do. And obviously there was a huge need, far greater need than the supply was ever able to meet. And that job became especially dangerous as Iraqis accompanied Americans out on patrols or on raids or even at city council meetings or meetings with tribal sheikhs, and the insurgents began to target them as collaborators. And so more and more of them had to disguise their identity, whether by hiding their face or by working in cities that were far from where they were born, by using American names, which soldiers gave them, like Christy and Andy. But there were a lot of other jobs, too, that Iraqis performed. So contractors who did construction work, day laborers, drivers, office managers at USAID in the Green Zone, secretaries at the U.S. Embassy. Really, you can count them in the thousands, those Iraqis who one way or another worked with Americans over the last 4 years.
So what are some of the typical problems that an Iraqi who's working with the Americans may face if their identity becomes known?
Death. Death by execution style. I mean, it has become a sure thing now that if your identity is revealed and you do not protect yourself either by leaving the country or quitting your job and hiding out at home or in some way making yourself scarce, you'll be killed. It's the most certain thing in Iraq today that those Iraqis working with Americans are targeted for death. They're the most vulnerable group, and they are the, in a way, the most hated group and the most persecuted by the insurgents and now by some of the Shia militias as well, because they're seen as agents of the occupiers. And one forgets, and many Iraqis forget, that 4 years ago, lots and lots of Iraqis wanted nothing more than to get a job with those occupiers. But over time, as the occupation has more than worn out its welcome, and as America's presence has grown more unpopular, even hated, the Iraqis who stuck it out and who've remained loyal and committed to the American presence, whether for money or because they believed in the vision, they are truly a homeless population in Iraq. No one is on their side, and they really can't protect themselves either, which is why, after seeing so many of their colleagues targeted, kidnapped, and killed, so many of them are now leaving the country.
So one of the few things that Sunni and Shia agree on now in Iraq is that they don't like Iraqis who are working with the Americans.
Exactly. It's a grim point of consensus. And even the Iraqi government, which one could say owes its position in some ways to the American army and the American government, its officials also seem to harbor contempt and suspicion for Iraqis who work with the Americans. I think that's partly an effort to burnish their own credentials as nationalists with their constituents. But an Iraqi can be going to work in the Green Zone, and an Iraqi guard at the gates of the Green Zone will shout out embassy when he sees the person's badge, and it's done to target that person. It's done to call attention to them. And I've heard so many stories of Iraqis whose neighbors spotted them on their way into the green zone, or who were recognized at a military base by someone they went to college with, or whose image appeared on television because a journalist forgot to turn off his camera when the interpreter was in the scene, and their lives are transformed. I mean, in a sense, they're marked at that point, and they have to take extreme measures to protect themselves.
Has the United States done anything to try to protect the Iraqis who are working with the Americans?
Basically, no. There are some individuals at the embassy, at USAID, and in the military, maybe more than anywhere else, who have taken a personal interest in an Iraqi who worked with them and who've tried to help them, whether to get them housing on a base or to get them a visa to the United States. I know of a sergeant major who's been working very hard to get several women who worked in his office and who are now refugees in Jordan visas to the U.S. But institutionally, astonishingly little has been done. Iraqis at the U.S. Embassy tried over and over again to get the smallest procedural changes made in order to be more secure. For example, they've always had to wait in line to get into the green zone with every other Iraqi who had any business that day in the green zone. But for them, they had to do it every day, and they had to show their badges in front of all these other Iraqis and display that they were working with the Americans. And they, a group that I talked to, went in and spoke with Ambassador, former Ambassador John Negroponte, and then again with other officials, and said, can you please let us into the priority lane where people, Americans and others with security clearances, can get into the green zone quickly and then search us once we're in the gates. But outside the gates, we're targets of car bombers and we're targets for insurgent lookouts. And over again, they were told, we can't do that. We can't change the rules.
Why not? Why can't they change them?
Well, the excuses given were, we would have to change the color coding of your badge, and if we did that for you, we'd have to do it for 300 other Iraqis, or we would have to change the wording of weapons permit on that priority lane badge from yes to no, and for some reason that might be a breach of security. I mean, the word security is sort of the explanation for all questions, and it became a word that the Iraqis I met grew to hate, because what it really meant was no. And we can't tell you exactly why not, but the answer is no. And what it told them was that they weren't trusted, that the security problem was them, and that they needed to be searched every time they came in and out of the embassy, even though Jordanians aren't searched every time they come in and out of the embassy. They couldn't have housing beyond, say, a week in a trailer in the green zone, even though Jordanians and other foreign nationals can live there for months on end. And what that told the Iraqis is, even though you work with us, even though you sacrifice for us, even though you risk your life every day, we really don't trust you. And I think that was one of the fundamental reasons why the answer was always no.
Is it getting hard to find Iraqis who are willing to work as translators or do anything else for Americans in Iraq?
Yes, it is. Although the pay is good, and so that has made it difficult for some people in those jobs to quit them and made it tempting for others to apply for them. But basically, at this point, you have to be you have to have nerves of steel to take a job like that. And it is getting harder. And the Americans have also made a decision to put Jordanians and other foreigners in jobs that used to be held by Iraqis at the embassy, because I think they simply found it easier to deal with their security concerns. They lived like Americans. They lived on in the green zone. They didn't have families in Baghdad who might be kidnapped or threatened. They didn't go home and risk being kidnapped themselves and threatened and blackmailed into giving information up, et cetera, et cetera. So the embassy has sort of taken the easy way, the short-term way, which is to allow Iraqis to leave, to not make a real effort beyond the pay raise to hold on to them, and to give those jobs to others. But, of course, the problem is Jordanians and others don't know anything about Iraq. It's the Iraqis who do. They have such a wealth of information that the Americans could, and in some cases have used, without them there, I think we're blinder than we've ever been, and we have been blind throughout.
What message does that send to Iraqis if it's now mostly Jordanians and people from other countries, like you mentioned, the Republic of Georgia, who are getting hired for those jobs?
I think it tells them that you're dispensable, that the potential threat you represent is great enough that we're willing to sacrifice some part of the mission here in order to be able to deal with it. And really that after 4 years, there isn't much of a relationship. I think this is the thing that struck me the most about my conversations with these Iraqis who worked with Americans. There was a sense of almost being a jilted lover or a discarded friend, a sense that we reached out to you, we wanted you, we were so happy to see you in our country, and this is what we've gotten. And there's a deep sense of betrayal.
My guest is George Packer. We're talking about his article, Betrayed, in the current edition of The New Yorker. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is George Packer. He's a staff writer for The New Yorker. We're talking about his article, Betrayed, which is in the current edition. It's about how Iraqis working with Americans in Iraq are now seen as collaborators and targeted for death, but they've received little protection from America. Now, you write about the Titan Corporation, which until December helped the Pentagon contract for employing interpreters in Iraq. And you say that this company became notorious among Iraqis for mistreating its foreign staff. What kind of reports did you hear?
Well, the mistreatment ranged from the petty, like sort of abusive language and making people wait for hours in the sun and not paying them on time, to what I think is really the criminal. For example, I talked to an interpreter who was in a Marine convoy that was hit by a roadside bomb, and the Iraqi interpreter suffered second-degree burns on his face and hands. He went to his hometown for medical care after being told after a week in the Green Zone hospital that he couldn't stay there any longer. He recovered. He drew a lot of suspicion in his hometown. What are you doing here? Why are you burned? Where have you been? And then he went back to the base to resume his job, and he found that Titan had essentially decided that he no longer existed. His badges had been destroyed, and they refused to pay him any compensation money for the time he spent recovering from injuries he sustained on the job. Very few Iraqis seem to know what's in their contract with Titan. Titan doesn't publicize those contracts. And when another woman at the same base received a death threat by phone and went to Titan to ask them what they could do for her, they essentially said to her, you can quit. And she said, if I quit, I'll be targeted when I go home. And they said, that's not our problem. So there's just this sense, and I think Titan in a way was worse than certainly the military, because their motive was the profit motive. The mission was not what brought them to Iraq. But just a sense that there was no strategic price to be paid for treating Iraqi employees this way, that they were disposable. You could always bring in more. That was what one interpreter said to me. We always told ourselves there are hundreds more like us if we don't want to keep doing the job and suffering these indignities. But there really was a strategic price to pay, because the lesson was learned not just by those Iraqis, but by all Iraqis, that the Americans were not willing to protect the people who worked with them, which just sort of destroyed the confidence of those Iraqis that the Americans were able to provide anything for Iraq. If they couldn't even provide good body armor for Iraqis working with American soldiers or diplomats, then why should anyone have any faith that America was providing Iraq itself with anything. It fed right into the propaganda line of the insurgents and made it very easy for the insurgents to convince the civilian population that these Iraqis were traitors.
Just to give more of a sense about what Iraqis in general, and particularly Iraqis who work with Americans, are up against, you were interviewing two people who have worked with Americans, and the only place that they were willing to talk to you was at the Palestine Hotel, a hotel where a lot of journalists stay, because it was the only place they felt safe being seen with an American. And one of those two people, it took them 3 days to get from their house in western Baghdad to the hotel. How many miles are we talking about, and why did it take so long?
Oh, we're just talking about maybe 3 miles, maybe four at the most, and the streets empty of traffic because so much of life has shut down. So it should have taken him about 15 minutes. He was at his parents' house in a insurgent stronghold in western Baghdad. That's essentially what he has to live with every day. He hates the insurgents, but he's surrounded by them and has to kind of make his peace with them. In order to get to me, he went to his sister's house a little further east, but his sister's house was in an area that was in the middle of Shiite-Sunni sectarian violence. He was trapped there for 2 days, watching firefights and street battles and houses around him burning down. On the third morning, his brother-in-law, who's Shiite, my friend was Sunni, walked him out past the Mahdi army militiamen, essentially saying, "He's with me, don't touch him," and put him in a taxi, where my friend went to his friend's house, spent another night there in a slightly safer, although not much safer, neighborhood. And then the next morning, they both went to the Palestine Hotel, which was literally the only place in Baghdad where we could meet. They felt going into the green zone was too dangerous for them. For me to come to them was out of the question. It would put us both in danger. And so we met in this creepy, deserted hotel at night with pretty loose security and all of us wondering, you know, is this place entirely safe? It used to be the major hangout for Western journalists, and now it's completely abandoned. There's almost no guests there at all.
Is that because it had been attacked before?
It had been the target of a massive suicide bomber with a cement mixer in late 2005. But it had already begun to thin out before then. It, just over the course of the last 4 years, with each returning trip, I've watched the Foreign Press Corps sort of disappear. And now there's just a few hardcore bureaus in a couple of little mini green zones around Baghdad. And none of them are at the Palestine Hotel any longer. So it had the feel of a rather sinister place at the tail end of a dismal war.
So the person who we're talking about, who it took 3 days to travel just about 3 miles from his home to meeting you at the Palestine Hotel, his family has had a lot of problems because of the war in Iraq. His two teenage brothers were kidnapped, and then one of his brothers was shot in the eye. And you describe how, you know, they took him to the hospital, but the hospital, you say the whole health system is under the Mahdi army's control. And he's the radical Shia cleric who has a militia. What does that mean, that the health system is under the Mahdi army's control?
Well, when the government of Iraq was formed after the elections, the ministries were divided among the political parties. And Muqtada al-Sadr sort of followed the Hezbollah pattern and went for the key sort of social ministries, education, health. So the Minister of Health is a member of his movement, and hospitals are plastered with posters of Muqtada al-Sadr. Female doctors are harassed by militiamen if they treat male patients or if they go without hijabs. Doctors are threatened routinely, and Sunni patients are at risk if they stay at the hospital for longer than a day or two, because there's really the security is provided by the Mahdi army, and the Mahdi army is looking for Sunnis. So my friend, who I call Othman in the piece, decided his brother with a bullet in his eye would be safer at home than in a hospital, so he took him home.
Now, you say that Othman, the man we've been talking about, when you spoke to him, he was paralyzed. He really wanted to leave, but he couldn't decide whether to leave or stay. Why was this decision so paralyzing?
It does seem like a no-brainer, doesn't it? Your younger brothers have been kidnapped and threatened within an inch of their lives, and your older brother has been nearly shot to death. But I think it speaks to the attachment Iraqis feel to their homes. I mean, obviously, everyone feels that attachment, but I find it intense in Iraq, stronger than in other countries where I've seen people fleeing. It takes a lot to pry Iraqis from their homes. This refugee population, and there's really almost 2 million of them who have fled the country, is not the sort of unwashed masses or the desperate and starving that we see in other refugee crises. They're largely middle class. They have homes. They have jobs. Their children are in school. They worry about their daughters completing high school and their sons completing college. They have what seemed to us like rather prosaic and familiar concerns. And for them to leave everything in Baghdad and really knowing that they may well never go back is an enormous decision. And Othman has finally made that decision. He's spent several thousand dollars on black market passports for his family. But he himself is going to have a very hard time leaving, even though his life is in danger every day.
George Packer's article, Betrayed, The Iraqis Who Trusted America the Most, is in the current edition of The New Yorker. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from ThinkMap, maker of the Visual Thesaurus, an interactive dictionary and thesaurus that helps bring language to life. More at visualthesaurus.com. From Endless Pools, swimming machines designed for exercise, fitness, and fun. DVD at 888-882-SWIM or endlesspool.com. And from Water Partners International, supported by the Agora Foundation, working to bring safe drinking water to people in the developing world at water.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, the war in Iraq's ripple effect on the region and on worldwide terrorism. We talk with Daniel Byman, director of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. And we continue our conversation with George Packer about the consequences Iraqis face for working with Americans in Iraq. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with George Packer, a staff writer for The New Yorker magazine and author of the 2005 book The Assassin's Gate, America in Iraq. He's made 6 trips to Iraq. The latest was in January. His article in the current edition of The New Yorker, Betrayed, is about Iraqis who have worked with Americans in Iraq and consequently have been labeled as collaborators targeted for death by Sunni and Shiite militias. You know, we've been talking about Iraqis who've worked for Americans and are in jeopardy because of that. Many of them are trying to leave the country or have already left the country. But it's not just Iraqis who work with Americans who want to leave. You say that last summer, Iraqis were fleeing the country at the rate of 40,000 people per month. And you describe this as a refugee crisis that is hidden. What is hidden about it?
Well, I mean, I think at this point it's the biggest refugee crisis in the world, but it's really only in the last 2 or 3 months that it's gotten international attention. First of all, they were not officially considered refugees. The vast majority of them who were in Jordan and Syria, because Jordan and Syria were not signatories to the 1951 Convention on Refugees, and also because the U.S. government did not want to see them as refugees. It regarded them as temporary displaced people. I think the term was temporary protected status, with the assumption that as soon as things stabilized, they would go back to Iraq. They wanted to go home. They were not looking to be resettled in third countries. And UNHCR, the UN Office on Refugees, sort of took its cue from the American policy and only registered small numbers of these hundreds of thousands of Iraqis. But I think pressure from refugee advocates and from journalists forced the UN and then the U.S. to change its stance, to ask for more money and more staff to register these people and to begin to ask third countries to start to accept them for resettlement. But up until now, a tiny, tiny number of them have been resettled. But the main point is they are refugees. They are not going back to Iraq anytime soon. The decision to leave was a huge one. And once they leave, they are in limbo. And Iraq is not a place where people are able to return easily.
You went to Syria because tens of thousands of Iraqis have fled to Syria. You said there's about 1 million Iraqis now. I'm not sure if they're all people who left after the 2003 invasion or whether some of those million had gone to Syria earlier.
I think almost all of them left after the invasion, mm-hmm. but there were different waves after the invasion. The first wave were essentially sympathizers of the former regime, Baathists and their friends and families who went to Damascus and Amman and in a way got to the front of the line and had enough money to be able to buy property. And now property values have skyrocketed because of the refugee population. And so they're looking pretty good. The next wave were fleeing kidnapping and economic crimes. They were middle class people with money, with businesses. But now it really is any Iraqi who can leave. Almost any Iraqi with the means to get out is getting out. And when I was in Damascus in January, I went one night to the bus station where the buses were coming in from Baghdad. And I met a driver of one of these minibuses. And I asked him, you know, who's coming here? And he said, everybody. I said, well, who's in Baghdad? He said, the only people left in Baghdad are those too poor to get out or those with a bad omen on their heads who will be killed in one of three ways: by kidnapping, by car bomb, or by militia. He sort of said it so categorically as if it was a fact that anyone left behind now was either poor or in some way cursed. Everyone else was trying to leave.
There were congressional hearings held by the Senate Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on Refugees, chaired by Ted Kennedy. And these were held in January, and that led in February, the State Department announced the formation of a task force to deal with the problem of Iraqi refugees. What's being accomplished so far?
Well, the task force was a good development, and so was the announcement that the U.S. government would be willing to resettle something like 7,000 Iraqis this year, which is an increase of about 20 times what have been resettled in the last couple of years. But so far, I don't think very much at all has been accomplished. And the way I measure it is by the people I know who I met during this trip and this reporting project. There's a guy who's stuck in Dubai in United Arab Emirates. His visa there is running out. They're not going to renew it because Iraqis are not welcome in these countries any longer. He worked for USAID. He got a death threat along with the symbolic severed upper half of a dog in his yard. He was essentially told, you're a dead man. He left the country. He went to Dubai. His visa's running out. He has nowhere to go. There's no other country that will take him where he has any chance of making a living. So he's really seriously thinking about returning to Iraq at the beginning of next month. And what does the task force have to offer him right now? Well, they've essentially said, you can begin registering with the UN, and we will put you in a kind of expedited line if you worked with the U.S., and perhaps in 6 months you will have come to the front of the line and been cleared by the UN and the Department of State, and then all the security checks of Homeland Security will have to take place, and that will push it even back farther. So maybe by the end of this year, this man has a chance of being resettled in this country. But what is he going to do for the next 9 months? He has no income. He has a young wife, and he's thinking seriously about returning to Iraq, which he said to me is like taking the decision to commit suicide. There are others who are in similar positions. These are desperate cases, and I know of them as individual cases, but you can only imagine that they're repeated in the hundreds or thousands. And I'm afraid there isn't enough of a sense of urgency. There isn't enough really political will to make this a priority. I mean, if we look back at the end of the Vietnam War, President Gerald Ford made a decision to cut through the bureaucracy and change immigration laws almost overnight in order to admit 130,000 Vietnamese by the end of 1975. We've admitted a couple of hundred Iraqis so far, and there is no sign yet to me that the administration sees this as such a moral obligation that they are willing to pay the political price for making it a top priority that Iraqis who worked with us will be brought to this country for their own safety. And until I see that beginning to happen on an individual level in cases that I know, I'm going to remain skeptical that it's going to happen at all.
How many people that you've met in your 6 trips to Iraq have been killed?
I think maybe 5, maybe 6.
And what are some of the circumstances?
Well, one was Sergio Vieira de Mello, the UN envoy who was killed in a car bomb. One was a politician named Akila al-Hashimi who was assassinated. One was an Iraqi fixer for the New York Times in Basra named Fakhr. One was, you know, just a friend of one of my friends who I met briefly and who I later heard had been killed. But, you know, more important than people I know, every Iraqi knows someone, and not just someone, but someone close to them who's been killed. It's kind of staggering what you begin to hear when you start to find out what daily life is like. I mean, for example, Othman in my story has just had one disaster after another befall his family, and he is just a tower of strength to be able to maintain his sanity and his judgment through this. But that's a typical case.
Well, in fact, why don't you leave us with the story of his two brothers getting kidnapped and how he tried to deal with the kidnappers on the telephone.
Yeah, Othman is a guy who I would want at my side in a crisis. You know, if I was about to be kidnapped, I would absolutely want him there because he's just very cool-headed. He's a doctor who then began working with Western journalists. He has two teenage brothers who he adores, and it's a Sunni family. And one day they didn't come home from their high school. This was in January. And he couldn't get them on the phone. And finally he got through on the cell phone and a stranger answered. And Othman said, where's Muhammad? Where's my brother? And the man said, he's right here. I'm looking at him. You're joking. No, I'm not joking. I've got both your brothers right here. Are you Sunni or Shia? And at that moment, Othman had to try to make the decision what to answer in order to save his brother's lives. And he actually gave the wrong answer. He said, we're Shia, because he assumed it was the Mahdi army that had kidnapped them. And after that, he lost contact with the kidnappers for a couple of hours. And his mother had also talked to the kidnappers. And they had said to her, how do you want your boys killed? Should we cut off their heads or chop them into pieces? We love chopping boys into pieces. I mean, it was really about as horrific as you can imagine. Finally, Othman, through his contacts with a Sunni political party, got a friend who knew insurgent groups to call these guys back. And this shows you that all Iraqis have to have contacts with everyone. They are so much more embedded in the in you know, the sides and in the violence and in the factions than we ever can imagine. And this friend convinced the kidnappers that the boys were, in fact, truly Sunni. The kidnappers were al-Qaeda members. And the boys were released with apologies and had their cell phones returned to them. And by the end of the afternoon, they were back home. But as Othman said to me, it was the worst day of my life, and I'll never forget the sound of that man's voice on the phone. But he also said to me, this has made me all the more determined to learn journalism so I can tell the world the story of what these people do. And so, in a sense, even at the absolute worst moment of his life, he is trying to find some way to redeem it. And I've seen that in other Iraqis, and it's the thing that inspires me about them and makes me want to keep telling their story, because we don't hear enough about that. What we only hear about is death and destruction, but there's an amazing spirit that has not completely been destroyed by this war.
George Packer, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Terry.
George Packer's article, Betrayed, The Iraqis Who Trusted America the Most, is in the current edition of The New Yorker. Coming up, we talk about the ripple effects of the war on the region and on worldwide terrorism with Daniel Byman, director of the Center for Peace and Security Studies at Georgetown University. This is Fresh Air. This week marked the fourth anniversary of the American invasion of Iraq and the start of the American military's fifth year there. The war has had many unintended consequences. My guest, Daniel Byman, writes about some of them in a paper he co-authored titled Things Fall Apart, containing the spillover from an Iraqi civil war. It was written for the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy, where Byman is a non-resident fellow. He also directs Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies and served on the staff of the 9/11 Commission. Daniel Byman, welcome back to Fresh Air. How do you think the war in Iraq is affecting the larger jihadist movement?
Iraq is one of the greatest boons to the global jihadist movement that they've ever had. Young men from around the Middle East and at times Europe and Asia are coming to Iraq, where it's a training ground for them to learn new technologies like improvised explosive devices. They're being indoctrinated into a more global ideology, so they may have gone there simply because they don't like the American occupation, but they're leaving believing that countries like Egypt and Saudi Arabia and Indonesia are illegitimate and the government should be overthrown. They're finding a network of individuals whom they can work with, and we'll see that network be used for 20 years, 30 years. But perhaps most importantly, it's unifying the movement. The broader radical Islamist movement is highly divided over a number of divisions that seem quite arcane to us, often on theology, and at times they're divided on practical questions. Whom to strike next? Is it more important to go after India or Russia and Chechnya? But Iraq brought this movement together because they could all agree that the U.S. occupation was something that they should fight against, and it made them heroes in much of the Muslim world. And this is something that is hard to quantify, but is going to make the movement that much stronger in the years to come, because it's given them credibility at a time when, 2003 in particular, when they seem quite weak to many people.
And we hear a lot about al-Qaeda in Iraq, which is the name of one of the groups in Iraq. Is al-Qaeda in Iraq directly affiliated with al-Qaeda?
Al-Qaeda in Iraq is directly affiliated with al-Qaeda, but not in the way that is often described. There was a jihadist movement in Iraq that had some loose links to al-Qaeda, and over time, because Iraq was such a popular struggle, became quite strong. Then there was a negotiation between the local leaders in Iraq and the al-Qaeda movement, the bin Laden movement, and in particular his deputy, Zawahiri. And this negotiation brought these two together, where each conceded a bit. What the local movement got was a global network and a certain degree of prestige in radical circles by affiliating with al-Qaeda. What the global movement got was a hot property, if you will, a hot organization that was in the heart of the most important struggle in terms of recruits and propaganda, and that was Iraq. So there was a win-win from this merger, but it wasn't Bin Laden creating a movement and nurturing it. It was a movement that was largely created by others and nurtured on its own.
Now, you recently co-authored a paper on how to contain the spillover from the civil war in Iraq, and this paper was based on studying recent civil wars in Afghanistan, Bosnia, Congo, Kosovo, Lebanon, Somalia, and other countries. You wrote this paper as part of your work with the Brookings Institution. Part of the paper is about preventing what's happening in Iraq from becoming full-scale civil war, but since you wrote the paper, do you think that it's reached that level of full-scale civil war?
Iraq is certainly in a full-scale civil war, but even within full-scale civil wars, there are degrees. And what we're seeing in Iraq is thousands of people dying on a regular basis in Iraq. But what we saw in a place like Congo is millions of people dying. And as horrible as the situation in Iraq is, it's worth pointing out that it could be worse. And a lot of what we are thinking about in this report is, if the United States leaves and if things start to get much worse, what are the consequences of that for the region? And the shorter answer is the consequences are bad.
One of the countries you're concerned about is Iran. Now, they already are playing some role in Iraq. What role would you say they're playing now, and what are you concerned? How might they escalate that role?
Right now, Iran is playing a massive role in Iraq. It has hundreds, perhaps thousands, of intelligence and paramilitary personnel on the ground. They are working with a wide variety of factions in Iraq, not only Shia groups, but also some Kurds. They're training, they're organizing, they're proselytizing. And in general, Iran is trying to have influence with as many different groups as possible. And it also wants influence on a local level as well as a national level. For Iran, a U.S. withdrawal is an opportunity to expand its influence. Iran is likely to try to see the resulting power vacuum as a way that it can become an even more important and an even more dominant power in Iraq. I'm not sure this will succeed, but in the short term at least, Iran is likely to try to expand its intelligence and paramilitary presence. And there's even a possibility that Iran could become more involved militarily should the sectarian war start to spill over even more, and should Iran believe it has an opportunity to aid particular proxies in the ensuing fight.
I don't know if you saw this. There was recently an article in the New York Times by Edward Wong, who's based in Iraq, and it was headlined, "Iran is playing a growing role in Iraq economy." And I'll just read you a few lines from the article. It said, "While the Bush administration works to stop Iran from meddling in Iraq, Iranian air conditioners fill Iraqi appliance stores, Iranian tomatoes ripen on the windowsills of kitchens here, and legions of white Iranian-made Peugeots sit in Iraqi driveways. Some Iraqi cities, including Basra, buy or plan to buy electricity from Iran. The economies of Iraq and Iran, the largest Shiite majority countries in the world, are becoming closely integrated, with Iranian goods flooding Iraqi markets and Iraqi cities looking to Iran for basic services." I think that's certainly an unintended consequence of the war in Iraq. What is your reading of the implications of that?
We shouldn't be surprised by this. It's natural that two neighbors are going to trade with one another, and ideally, more is better. The United States, of course, trades has a huge trade relationship with both Canada and Mexico. But this is another potential form of Iranian influence. Iran can manipulate trade, it can manipulate the border to make life better or worse for Iraqis. And any government that's in power in Baghdad has to recognize this reality, that Iran is not only a force on the ground militarily in terms of paramilitary and intelligence forces, but also has tremendous influence over Iraq's economy.
So you're concerned about Iran becoming more deeply involved with Iraq, and you're also worried about the Saudis becoming involved in Iraq to counter Iran's influence. Why would the Saudis, why might the Saudis feel that they needed to do that?
The Saudis may have multiple reasons to become involved. One is that they fear Iran and they fear the rise of the Shia in Iraq. So they may aid their own proxies in an attempt to at least hurt their opponents or at least weaken their power. They also may believe that Iraq would become a stepping stone for Iranian influence throughout the rest of the Arab world. That seems a bit far-fetched to me, but the Saudis are quite paranoid about this. And this fear is shared by a number of other Sunni Arab states that are very worried both about their own domestic Shia, but also about the specter of Iranian power in the region.
My guest is Daniel Beiman, director of Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Daniel Beiman. We're talking about a paper he co-wrote for the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy called Things Fall Apart, Containing the Spillover from an Iraqi Civil War. You caution in your paper about the ripple effects of the war in Iraq that the United States shouldn't try to pick a winner in the Civil War. Why not?
Well, sitting here from Washington, it's very tempting to think of Iraq as a chessboard. And if you move one piece, if you strengthen one side, you can really do this quite artfully. In reality, to pick winners, you have to have tremendous intelligence about the local military balance of forces. And in Iraq, we don't know who the best military commanders are. We also don't know the relative strengths of the different sides. And this is in large part because the Sunnis and the Shia in particular have numerous internal divisions. In the United States, people often talk about the Shia as if it were a single community with a single voice and a single set of leaders. In reality, the Shia leaders are often heavily divided. Shia militias have fought against one another. So it's not clear who's going to show up to fight and who's going to fight against whom. And in those circumstances, it's very difficult to choose one side and help guide it to victory.
Okay, so your recent paper is about the ripple effects of the war in Iraq and what the ripple effects would be if the United States pulled out of Iraq. From your position now, what do you think the United States should do? Should it stay in Iraq because things are such a mess there now, or should it pull out because things are such a mess there now, and what are the consequences of either actions?
I'm personally pessimistic about the chances for the United States achieving victory at this point. I think that we have a strategy and a military leadership that I think understands what needs to be done, but the mission is still woefully understaffed and under-resourced. We don't have nearly enough troops, and the insurgent groups are quite strong. The local political structures are weak and corrupt, and so in general, I'm pessimistic. And I would add that I don't think the American people are going to be tolerant of a mission that's going to last another 10 or 15 years, which, in my judgment, is what this thing is going to take if it's going to have a chance of victory. If victory is off the table, we get into questions of what do you do instead. And for me, walking away completely could be disastrous. As we discuss in the paper, there are a host of problems that could destabilize not only Iraq, which is already close to being a basket case, but also many neighboring states, including such important allies as Jordan, Saudi Arabia, and Turkey. And we need to think very heavily because we have tremendous interests in those regions. And to do this, I would say that the United States should be thinking hard about how to minimize spillover from Iraq. The United States should be thinking about how to contain this problem rather than, unfortunately, how to solve it, which I don't think is practical at the moment. And this requires a very different way of thinking and approaching the U.S. military presence and U.S. political goals in the region.
I mean, because right now what we're doing is fighting militarily. So how could we use the resources we have to contain the problem as opposed to trying for victory?
Containment emphasizes trying to stop the problems from spreading to regional states. So this involves working with regional states to police refugee camps, trying to make them stronger bureaucratically, trying to make them stronger economically, trying to help them guard against terrorism, countering some of the economic effects, and also trying to dissuade states like Iran or Syria or even allies like Saudi Arabia from increasing intervention in Iraq, in particular military intervention. But it's worth pointing out that a containment strategy has huge costs as well. In particular, as we discussed, Iraq could go from a horrible situation to one that's truly off the charts, where instead of thousands of people are dying, tens or even hundreds of thousands of people are dying on even a monthly basis. And we've already seen 2 million refugees from Iraq. That number could double. And when you're going to a containment strategy, you are effectively saying the United States is not going to be able to solve the humanitarian nightmare of Iraq. And that's tragic. That's horrible. But at this point, I'm quite pessimistic that the United States has that capability.
Have you been talking to anybody about this who actually has some decision-making power in the U.S. government?
We've been talking to people in the U.S. government, in the military, in the intelligence community, and also a fair number of people in Congress about our ideas and about our plans. My personal frustration is that even if you believe that the surge will work, you should nevertheless be considering the possibility that it will fail. The failure to plan for negative contingencies, for things going wrong, was one of the ultimate flaws of the U.S. decision to invade Iraq in the first place. And right now, we need to be doing Plan B. We need to be thinking of alternatives to the current plan, because 2 years down the road, 1 year down the road, 3 months down the road, we might need that Plan B. And my colleague Ken Pollack and I at Brookings have tried to start this process, but this is something that requires a massive interagency effort, and to my knowledge, is not being done in a serious, comprehensive way.
So you don't think there's a Plan B?
To my knowledge, no.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Daniel Bimon is a fellow at the Brookings Institution's Saban Center for Middle East Policy and is the director of Georgetown University's Center for Peace and Security Studies. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer is Roberta Sharrock. Our engineers are Julian Hertzfeld and Bob Purdick. Welcome back, Bob. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Tariq Rose.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Virginia Woolf's early novel, Night and Day, in stores and online at bn.com. From the Horace W. Goldsmith Foundation, supporting the Museum of Modern Art in Midtown Manhattan, information at moma.org. And from audible.com, where you can download and listen to Fresh Air, in addition to audiobooks, magazines, and newspapers, audible.com/freshair. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Will Ferrell talks about his movies, his years on Saturday Night Live, and his childhood. Ferrell stars in the new comedy, Blades of Glory. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.